Welcome to Speakers Forum. I'm John O'Brien. In this extra episode, author Claire Dieterer was 44 years old and living a successful life, literary accomplishment, comfortable marriage, family, and home, when something caught up with her. Periodic ruminations about her teen self, quote, a disastrous pirate slut of a girl, unquote, in conjunction with a kiss from a man, not her husband, triggered a wave of reflection and writing about the person she once was and became. The result is her memoir, Love and Trouble, A Midlife Reckoning. Claire Dieterer grew up in Seattle and still lives in the area. She became a best-selling author in 2010 when she published her first book, Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. She spoke with KEXP DJ Cheryl Waters on May 12th at Town Hall Seattle. Sonia Harris recorded their talk. Please note this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. Here, Katie Sewell introduces the reading and discussion.
Claire Dieterer is the author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses, which has been translated into 12 languages. She is a book critic, essayist, and reporter, and a longtime contributor to the New York Times. She's also written for The Atlantic, Vogue, Slate, The Nation, The New York Times Magazine, among other publications. And her latest book, which brings us all here tonight, is called Love and Trouble, A Midlife Reckoning. And our moderator tonight is Cheryl Waters. Cheryl is the host of The Midday Show on KEXP, which is from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. every Monday through Friday. She began DJing at KEXP back when it was called KCMU in April 1994, and she tells me that she still loves it as much today as she did then. Please join me in welcoming Claire and Cheryl to the stage.
So to start, I will read from the book, and Cheryl will gaze at me adoringly like I'm running for office. I want to start with some thank yous. I want to thank Town Hall. I think that their mission here is incredible, and they fulfill it in so many different ways, and we're really lucky to have it. I want to thank Cheryl for being here. It's a huge honor for me to be here with her. I think she's the best. I want to thank Elliott Bay for being here and selling books. Obviously, it's a really important institution in our city. And right now, we need these humanist, humane institutions more than ever, and independent booksellers are them. And I want to, in particular, thank both Rick and Karen, who are here, who both have supported me during my dark nights of the soul working on this book. I want to thank my family and friends who are here and everyone who has written and talked about and tweeted about and all the things you're supposed to do for the book to support it in its wonderful first week of life. Thank you. Have I forgotten anything? Well, thanks to all of you for being here. I really appreciate you coming out. I'll jump right in. Chapter one, You Now. You did everything right. You made some friends you could count on. You got a job, you found a mate, a really nice one, and you bought a house and had kids. You didn't even think about it that much, you just did it. You worked really hard all the time. You were a faithful wife, and it's okay to say it out loud, an above average mom. And you dressed cute, but not too cute. You were a little afraid. You were a lot afraid. You could feel your chaotic past behind you. You could hear the girl you were, a disastrous pirate slut of a girl, breathing down your neck. You wanted nothing to do with her. But sometimes, late at night, while the babies and the husband were asleep, you drank Maker's Mark in your living room, even though you were still breastfeeding. And you should ask a question later. And you listened to music alone in the dark, and that girl came closer and closer until you turned off the music and went to your marital bed and slept your dreamless, drunken sleep. You woke up and your teeth felt like nervy stubs from all the grinding. You had a headache that lived inside your teeth. You accumulated this life over a decade, maybe two, like a midden or the nest of a bowerbird or a creepy shut-in's collection of nail clippings. Anyway, it all piled up, accreted, because that was the way you wanted it. You are the kind of person who gets what she wants. You wanted to accumulate this beautiful life, a life that, for all its beauty, ignored the person you had been. You worked your ass off getting here. You moved to the country, or that's what you called it. Just because you take a ferry to get there and you have farmers for neighbors, that doesn't make it the country. It's just very, very picturesque suburbs. In the fake country, there was all the nature you craved. You had woods in your new backyard and a badminton lawn and a poorly kept garden you described to yourself as romantically overgrown, and the schools were terrific. You bought a nice new couch because toddlers left the old one as stained with shit and vomit and blood as the back seat of Travis Bickle's taxi. In your safe, pretty house in the alleged country, across the water from the city where you grew up, you mostly forgot about the girl you were, the lost soul. She was such a clueless bitch, you didn't really want to think about her anyway. Maybe you conjured her at parties with new friends, parents from your kid's school who laughed politely at your crazy stories. You woke up embarrassed the next morning. And then one day, it's as if a switch is flipped. This day comes in April 2011. The spring, you are 44 years old. You don't know it yet, but on this day, your season in hell has begun. You stumble out of bed. Your husband, a journalist, is headed somewhere far away on assignment, but before he leaves, he brings you coffee in bed and then yells up the stairs at your children. You rise and go into the kitchen, lean dizzily against the counter, and watch them come in their multitudes. Well, there are only two of them. But they seem like more in the morning. Your daughter, solemn and big-eyed and possessed of a slyly wicked sense of humor, is 12. Just around the age you were when you started going off the rails. Does her 12-ness fill you with anxiety? If so, you're not quite admitting it to yourself. She grows more beautiful every day, even as you grow homelier, no matter how many chaturangas you perform. Your daughter appears to be coolly lit from within by some tiny inner moon. Does her comparative glowiness make you feel your own youth is drawing inexorably to a close? Again, not in any way you care to admit. Your son, for now, is a simpler matter. 9 years old, uncomplicatedly loving, gleefully loud, and here they come every morning with their crazed hair and vacant eyes. They are like sleep-hot monsters who need to have the wildness of dreaming smoothed and fed and nagged out of them. Your husband is picking up his suitcase and heading out the door, and the kids are looking for their shoes. Because from the time they're born until they're 18, there will be one constant, lost shoes. Your life is relentlessly communal. You are necessary in every conceivable way. This is how you wanted it to be. Blessedly alone at last, you sit down at your computer to work on an overdue article. Your focus is shitty. Through the open window, you hear the call of a spotted Towie. Was that Vic? That's so funny. Towie, right? Which sounds exactly like the Austin Powers theme song. The spring air is the very gas of nostalgia. It reminds you of schoolrooms, of wanting to flee your desk, of the escape artist you used to be. As you sit there, you find that all of a sudden, you can't stop thinking about her, the girl you used to be. I'll stop there.
Hi. I just want to say that I called Claire one night from the bathtub where I do a lot of my reading. And I am a person who gives books away many, many years ago. I tried to put my name in them and keep track of them, and I would lend them out to people, and then I would fret for months when somebody didn't return a book that I didn't get it back. So I'm sort of like a read and release person, and I'm so happy to rebuy a book if I want to read it. But I can't bring myself to write in a book. I couldn't even do it in college. So I called Claire from the bathtub because this is the first time I've done something like this, and I wanted to keep track of memorable things, and I'm like, do you write in a book? And she admitted she didn't, and I also use a bookmark, but she said, I just turned down the pages, because she's a book critic, so
don't
she has to keep track.
Don't tell Sylvia Haven.
But I wanted to make a mark every time I saw something meaningful that I wanted to talk about, and I don't know if you can see it from here, but every page has turned down in it, and then I ran against the problem, what if on the back side of the page that you've turned down, you want to, so I just realized now that I could have bent it at the bottom, but this is a book so full of so much, and it is just such an honor to be here tonight. So this isn't going to be useful for me because I've turned the page down on every page. But man, yowza, Love and Trouble, a midlife reckoning. That book packs a wallop, and I just want to jump right in.
Okay.
The Claire Dieterer humor is in full effect in this book, as evidenced by what you just read, and it just keeps going.
Thank you.
Is a dark book, and this is not Poser. When did you know that you were going to write this book? And did you know it was going to be this book?
No. I'm still not sure I even know what this book is. It's complicated and it has so much stuff in it. It feels like it's still a little bit outside my understanding. The genesis of the book was after I published Poser, I simultaneously went through a depression and at the same time, perhaps related, I was trying to write a book about Roman Polanski. And I thought maybe it would be a biography or a critical. I used to be a film critic, so a long critical work. And as I was working on it, first of all, I realized he was just so awful. And then I realized I was less interested in Polanski than I was interested in the rape of Samantha Gailey in 1977. And then I sort of from there realized maybe I was a little bit less interested in the rape than in the girl. And then I realized maybe I was interested in my own experience of the 1970s and my own sexual coming of age. So I wrote for a long time on that, about growing up in the 1970s and kind of bohemian 1970s. And then after a while, I was like, why am I writing about this girl who just annoys me, this young girl who was just like so much trouble and was such a bad kid and got herself in trouble all the time. And I realized it was kind of, and who was sad all the time. I was a really melancholic kid. And I realized it's because I was experiencing all those same things again in my 40s. And once I saw the two periods in dynamic with each other, that really was when I knew what the book was about. And that period I just described to you took about 4 years, I'd say.
You say that it is a very complicated book. It really is. And you've written about yourself in such a very savage way. And I wonder if you feel like you're being hard on yourself. I mean, how important is it to have that brutal honesty as a memoirist?
Well, I think that there's kind of two things going on. I think on the part of it is the book opens. I mean, you heard the language. I refer to myself as this disastrous pirate slut of a girl. And sort of the opening of the book, I'm looking back on myself and I'm mad at myself. You know, I mean, who wants to think about their younger self? Like, imagine going back and looking at your diaries. Doesn't it sort of fill you with horror? No? Anyone? I was always really uncomfortable thinking about the time in my life when I perceived myself as being bad. Now that I was married and a good worker and a mom and, you know, sort of had built this life. So there is this savagery of me looking at myself and being mad at myself and kind of growing out of that over the course of the book. But I also think that there's an honesty about my experience that is another kind of, I wouldn't say savage, I would just say it's very clear. And I think that, you know, I really believe that memoir has this mandate to say what is difficult. And when we say what is difficult, then the reader reads it and feels less alone. If we don't say what's difficult, then we haven't fulfilled the kind of the moral mandate of the memoir. Then it's just narcissistic. So if you're gonna do it, you really had better be looking at the dark stuff. There's a way that memoir does this that no other art form can do. And if we're going to write it, we have to step into that. And so I think there's this path in the book where I'm looking at the younger self and I'm being pretty savage toward her at the beginning, and then I become more gentle. But with the contemporary self, I'm, you know, mean to her throughout.
Yeah. You are very tender with mm-hmm. the younger self, and it is a very tender book. You know, you talk about that brutal honesty, and you're an experienced enough writer to know that role of the memoirist, which you just outlined.
Yeah.
But I wonder, you know, when you are, it is you, you're putting yourself out there. I mean, was it hard at first? Did you find yourself mincing along, or did you just go with total abandon?
When I wrote Poser, I was really mincy around the difficult moments. And I always say that I, like, whenever I would come to a difficult moment, I would sort of be like the juggler, like, do, 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 like, look, you know, sort of do a fancy little dance around the hard thing. But then when I published the book, the things that I said that I was embarrassed of or ashamed of, things about ambivalence or dark feelings, those were the things where people would come up and hug me and thank me and cry at readings. So that was amazing to have in working on this book, because I then knew when you found something that was really difficult like that, I knew that from a literary point of view, it was something to go toward. And I mean, it was horrifying to write about my sex life, or it was cringy or whatever, but there was also, I would say there was a quality of glee. Yeah, I would say there was a quality of like, if we're gonna do it, let's do it, right? And like, this is my job. I don't wanna be the kind of memoirist who just gives you the surface. I think that that's, I think it's a wank. I do.
You rake yourself over the coals when you talk about your bad behavior. You just said that, and you kind of just answered this question, but I'm wondering, did you enjoy it? You asked Ariel Levy that question, and I've been dying to ask you that question as well.
Wait, what did I...
You rake yourself over the coals when you talk about your bad behavior. Uh-huh. I'm wondering, though, did you enjoy it?
Enjoy the raking or enjoy the behavior?
I guess you can answer both. But I was thinking, you know, did you sort of secretly enjoy raking yourself over the coals?
I would say the answer to both is yes. I enjoyed doing it, and I enjoyed raking myself over the coals. And I can't remember what Ariel said when I was interviewing her. I think...
she enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, and that's like a great... she wrote that book, The Rules Do Not Apply, that came out last month, and it has this quality when she's being just an asshole. She kind of just goes after it in this really interesting way that's very unusual. So yeah, I think I did enjoy it.
Your book is very unusual as well. There is really not a book out there like this. Were you... I'm wondering, did you know what your book was going to be about, the themes you were going to cover as you were writing it? And at what point did you realize no one's really saying this?
I wrote a review of two memoirs about midlife about 3 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, they were sort of two comic memoirs, and they both were dealing with the sort of world terror that overtakes you at this age, not you, but me. And it was from a very female point of view. And both of these books kind of got hold of the idea that what was happening was menopause. And I was so deeply offended by this idea. Like, I felt like what I was going through was my realization that I'm a dying animal. Like, I'm no longer going to be able to procreate. And I can kind of see this universe, the universal human experience on the horizon. And yet, and men write it. I mean, every male novel and memoir of the 20th century, not every, but a lot of them deal with this. And when men write about this, it's a universal human experience. When women write about it, it's menopause. And yeah, you're staying in place very well. So I think that reading those other books and realizing how badly they were serving me, I mean, they were fine books, but it was like, at that moment I realized there's nobody out there who's dealing with taking a female experience and asking men to see it as a universal human experience, right? It just, that was what I wanted, was to write about my own very specific experience and reflect something that was truly universal. I don't want it to be a woman's book. I want it to be a universal book about this time of life.
And it's connecting with readers in such a major way and connecting with men, women as well as men. Did you feel like that was a book for everyone when you were writing it?
Well, I felt like there's this paradox that you can really only achieve any kind of universality through writing your own really specific experience. And I think everybody who's a writer in the room knows that that can be really scary, especially when it comes to writing memoir, because you're writing down these details of your experience, and it's like, who the fuck cares what I ate for breakfast, or that it was a towhee outside the window, or whatever it is. Like, why does that matter? But I just kept focusing on the particulars of my own experience and trusting that the universal would arise from it. So I don't know what I was trying to do, except for really trying to prod my own experience with as much intelligence and feeling as I could, and trusting this other thing would happen. And again, that was a huge benefit of it being a second book, because I'd kind of seen that, the physics of that in action with the first book.
Obviously, it's your second book. You write for a living. You've been doing it for a really long time. But I mean, how do you feel that you've grown as a writer? I mean, the writing is stunning in this book.
Thank you. Gosh. Yeah, I definitely feel like I've grown as a writer. I don't know how to talk about this without referring to my friend Victoria Haven, who's a big part of this book. She's a character in the book. She's an artist here in Seattle. Most of you probably know, or many of you probably know her, or if not her, then her work. And she, in a way, was a collaborator on the book. And she is, I don't know how to say this, she's very, very, very ambitious and uncompromising in her own work. That's her husband laughing, because he's like, yeah, uncompromising. So, I had always felt like ambition and lack of compromise was something that belongs to fine art and doesn't belong to popular memoir. And I just was like, why not? And so I really feel like I followed her example and just tried to look at the writers I thought were the greatest writers and write to their level and think about them, whether they were dead or alive, and please myself on a certain level, please my highest standards, the way I saw Victoria doing. So I learned a lot from her, and I think one of the reasons it really works is because we work in different art forms. I think that's one of the reasons it's been such a productive, I mean, we've been friends since we were 23, but this new phase of our friendship, I think, has been really productive, just because there's no, writers are horribly competitive and mean-spirited and petty and small, but we don't have to have that between each other because we're in different fields. And she's really nice to me. Oh my God.
It sounds like she's brutally honest with you, though, which is...
I don't know. She's always so nice. I don't know. Yeah, she is brutally honest. Yeah, if something's not good enough or if something is not up to my par, she'll look askance.
Friendship is such a strong theme in this book, and it sort of feels like you couldn't have gotten through this without Victoria.
Well, I think that one thing that the book, I mean, gotten through this, like, what is it that I'm getting through? A lot of you haven't read the book, but what I'm getting through is basically the most garden variety midlife experience of depression when everything, you know, it's just like so privileged. Like, I have work, my husband has work, we have two healthy children, you know, we all like each other. It's just, I mean, knock wood. It's just like all of that stuff is in place. But what I experienced was just a really strong questioning of my own, of what I was doing here on the planet, all the and just a deep, deep melancholy and sadness. And what one of the answers I discovered really was that we don't know what's going to help us when we get really sad. But if we get too hung up on a right answer, like, you know, I can only be happy within the construct of my nuclear family, or I can only be happy within the construct of my job, or whatever it is, we lose a lot of opportunity to find a way out of the wilderness. And for me, friendship was that thing that kind of helped pull me out. I mean, she's, you know, crying her way along beside me. I think that's okay to say.
When you started going through this sadness, this deep depression, it brought you back to your early childhood, some of your earliest experiences, and your earliest experience with sex vexed you. I've stolen that from somewhere. Vexed. Either you said it or a reviewer said it, but Ennis used the word vexed. I'm all over
as
it.
As a reviewer.
But you look at your early teenage sexuality from a number of angles in Love and Trouble, and I'm just curious, what did you come up with? What did your character want?
I think that that's one of the things that's really interesting in the book, is that I'm trying to figure out why I was sexually active as a teenager. And I think that I look at it from a lot of different angles. I think I was looking for love. I think that I was... I had had an early sexual experience that I think shaped me and made me more sort of open to that kind of activity. And I also think my children are in the audience, so this is like really complicated. But I also think I liked it. I enjoyed it. Sex is fun, you guys. I'm sorry, I apologize to them. But I think that at the end of the book, there's still a lot of ambivalence about it. There's still a lot of, I liked it, but I didn't like it. I wanted it, but I didn't want it. And I think this is very, it's not a memoir that's just like, you know, Susie Bright, yay, sex. I mean, it's looking at sexual experiences, especially for the young, from a lot of different angles, and saying that for most young women, it's really packed with a lot of cultural expectations, often with experiences of assault or molestation, and often just with feelings of shame. And I try to get at all of that and look at it. And I don't solve anything, but I just keep, you know, it's just like, it's like this object in the middle of the room, and I'm just walking around it, and there's no answers at the end of the book.
You grew up in an interesting time. There was sort of a sexual exploration, and our parents were going through all kinds of new ideas, and I'm wondering if you feel like a lot of the people that are relating with you are from your generation, or if you're meeting people of all ages. You talked about an interview you did with a woman who was older than you that was amazing, and I am from the same era as you, so I could relate. Are you going to tell that story?
Well, I mean,
I welcome it made me laugh.
But
answer this question first. I'm wondering how the book is resonating with people of different generations. I see people here of all ages today. You and I are the same age, so I was going through the same... I could relate to a lot of it. It was my same experience. I felt like, you say it better than me in the book about what was going on in the 70s.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a lot of people who are writing to me right away saying, your story is my story. That is happening. And there's that level. When I wrote Poser, which was about being a mom in Seattle in the early 2000s and the pressures of that, I heard a lot from women my age, and then I heard a lot from their moms who were like, I've been trying to figure out what the fuck is wrong with my daughter because she's so uptight. So there was this really interesting dual level of responses. Like, I heard a lot from grandmas who were like, all I want to do is play with my grandson. I don't know. But reading the book, they understood better. This book feels more all of a piece. I'm hearing from women in their early 20s all the way to a woman who I spoke with who said, well, your experience isn't my experience. I was telling Cheryl this story, and I thought she was sort of judging me, and she said, but it does kind of remind me when I used to go to orgies in the Upper West Side in the late 60s. And I was just like... So what I'm hearing is a lot of women who are reading the book, and because I'm prodding at the complexity of what it is to want and be wanted is what's really at the core of the book. When you say that's like one of the hearts of the book, it seems more open in a more, you know, it's not so specific to one age. It seems like a lot of women are responding to that part of the book of all ages. Well, but it's only been out since Tuesday, so who knows?
That's true.
Yeah.
What about men? What's their response been?
Well, fear. And really a lot of fear. I've had the most beautiful reviews, and like the Christopher Frizzell piece was really well considered, and there was a beautiful piece by David Ulan. So I was really surprised at the sensitivity with which men have looked at the book. And I do notice that the women tend to get into the muck in writing about the book and talk about the emotions and stuff, and the men tend to like focus on the structure. Because it's a really structurally, there's a lot of formal play in the book, and that's a really important part of the book, and I love talking about that. I could talk about that all night, because it's
that's
like...
That's crazy. That's going to be my next question.
But what's that?
That was going to be my next question.
Awesome.
I mean, it's such beautiful writing. It really doesn't get any better than this, and you use this very unusual structure. I'm curious where that came up as an idea. I mean, in my mind, I was thinking... Was it sort of an artifice to get past writer's block or procrastination?
Yes.
And then you thought, wow, this is cool. I'm just going to use it. I mean, talk a little bit about...
No, you just said it. The thing you just said.
Some of the formats that you use in the book.
Okay. So the book has... let's see. There's different formats. There's a couple chapters that are letters to Roman Polanski. He never quite got out of there, which is definitely the most polarizing aspect of the book critically. People either love it or hate it. There's an ABCs of life at Oberlin. So it's like A is for acid, B is for butt rock. There's a Dante and Virgil. There's Dante and Virgil in LA, where Victoria and I go to Los Angeles and travel through the nine circles of hell. I can't.
It's super fun.
I can't, the opening piece that I read to you is in second person. There's a chapter set at the Seven Gables where I worked in 1985, where I was a popcorn girl, that's written in as a wee voice about me and all the other dreaming girls work in our uniforms working behind the counter. So there's a bunch of different ideas. And I wrote the book, and a lot of my students in the room will really laugh at me. But I was really trying to write this very smooth, pablum-like narrative memoir where it would all be in scene and everything would be very beautiful and literary, and doing my best to write that way, and which just to write it as a really traditional memoir. And it was super boring, and it was also really sad. Like, a lot of the things I was trying to deal with that had to do with melancholy and the challenges of coming of age and the challenges of midlife, when they were in that form, it was just like really lyrical, really resonant, and really like dull and sad. And so I would sneak off and do these forms for entertainment, to entertain myself, and just like really just go off and do them. And I'm sorry, I don't know why I'm doing this to Vic, but, and Vic said, look, you already wrote the book. And because she saw that it was all already there in these different forms, and she said, you need to look at Visit from the Goon Squad, and so, which is that amazing novel by Jennifer Egan. Great book. And so I did, and I realized I had already written the book, and then the editor who bought it had actually edited Visit from the Goon Squad, so that was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
It was really cool.
Memories are tricky things, and I'm curious how much you... considered or were concerned whether your memories were accurate. I mean, no matter how dedicated you are to self-reflection as a memoirist, you have blind spots.
Yeah.
And so I'm also interested what your relationship with your editor is like.
So I will tell a story about my first editor on my first book, who was a very respected editor of memoir. She had edited Mary Carr. And she, again, all my students know this story, but when I went to New York to ask her, like, as I'd started to write, and I was like, holy crap, how am I going to write this? Because I can't remember what this person said or what happened in that scene. I have to invent it. You know, I have to kind of construct it the best I can. And she said, we were having a glass of wine, and I said, what am I going to do? And she just leaned across the table to me and said, it's all fiction. So take that as you will. That is not my policy. But There's a lot of stuff in this book about an age that I did not want to think about for 30 years or more. And I don't understand the memories entirely. And I deal with that in the book. I'm like, am I remembering this right? Did it go like this? You know, how would other people remember it? And my editor never pushed on that at all. I never heard back from her on that. But I had an awareness of it that, you know, I don't know. I just did my best. I mean, constructing things from memories is very difficult. In this case, I did do research on my own book. I had boxes and boxes of diaries, photos, and letters in my basement. And I did do...
You actually put a call out on Facebook. Does anyone remember the record store?
Yeah.
On the app?
Oh, my God. I have never seen a more rabid Facebook fight. Then what was the record store just north of 42nd on the east side of the street? Roxy Music, I think. I think Yesterday and Today was over there, but good guess.
We're almost to the Q&A, okay. And I really do just want to ask this one question. You don't have any answers at the end of this book, and Poser didn't necessarily tie things up into a pretty bow, but there were little life lessons to be learned in those chapters, and there's none of that here, and I'm wondering, was that intentional or maybe inevitable?
Yeah, so I love that you asked that question. I'm very happy right now. I wanted to, you know, memoirs tend to go toward, and Poser did this, tend to go toward this point where they reach resolution. And I mean, we're all living people here, and we know that that doesn't really happen ever. Like, that's not how life unfolds. We don't resolve stuff. And in fact, that's the theme of the book, is me returning to the person I was and realizing, like, that girl, that disastrous pirate slut, didn't go away altogether. She, you know, it's still there. And so we don't sort of, maybe we act better. I'm not sure we get better. And so I really wanted to write a book that was, I kind of wanted to write a book that was about failure, that was about not getting better. So that was what I was trying to do. Maybe it falls short of being a book of failure, but at least it doesn't tie up. And yeah, that was my dream, was to do what you just said. That was one of my big ambitions. So thank you.
Well, there doesn't seem to be reconciliation per se at the end, but there seems to be a lot of self-understanding and compassion, maybe a modicum of peace.
Maybe. Yeah, sure. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if with the kind of person that I am, the way that I am so relentlessly questioning and critical, I don't know if peace is something that's going to be available to me or even is a something I should strive for. Like, but I do think that, yeah.
With all that yoga?
Yeah, not. Think of what I'd be like without the yoga. Jesus. Somebody said something to me. Actually, it was a writer from The Stranger said something to me last week, and I think it's really funny. It was someone from The Stranger, because this is such a hippie-ish thing to say. He said that he thought compassion and clarity are the same thing. And I think that that feels closest to where this book ends up and to my best days are days when I can be clear, and it's the same thing as compassion. That's a lot of just abstract words.
Sounds good to me.
Okay, good. Anyway. Yeah. Let's go all night.
Yeah. Okay, I will try to ask a question.
Hi.
So what happened to the girl, and what happened to the perfect wife? What kind of relationship do you have with them today?
Wow, that's a big question.
Short.
And it had a question mark. What if all my answers to all these questions are, I don't know. I mean, the perfect wife, like as a construct, sounds dumb, but that's just being with my family and being happy and taking care of them and having that daily pleasure of that, which is honestly the, you know, 80% of what I do and what gives me pleasure. I mean, it's just making a little room. Honestly, it's making a little room for adventure. It's making, you know, you don't have to like
run off to Thailand with your lover or become a polyamorist, and you don't have to like be a poser person, like sitting in your house only having wooden objects around you and being anxious. There's something in between. And you know, Bruce, my husband, is an adventure and environmental writer, and he has traveled all over the world for his work. And he has been amazing about trusting me to go out in the world and travel and go off on jaunts on my own. And so I think somehow it's just finding, for me, discovering like, oh, that part of life, of going out and being in the world, is really important, and I don't want to let it go. So I think that's my answer. Hi, Vera.
You said that you did a lot of research in reading your own journals. That sounds really brave. How the hell did you not get bogged down by all the emotion and sadness and stuff that you found in those journals? And was there any kind of process you could do to rescue yourself from deep despair?
I did not say that I didn't get bogged down. And I did. It was really hard. I mean, especially because I was doing that research as I was in the experience of being, you know, really having a hard time. But I just did it. It was self-indulgent, just sitting around the floor of my little hut reading my journals. And it was awful. But I read them all through, beginning to, I laid them out, 1975 to 1997, or whatever they are. You know, a girlhood lost. And I read them all in a row, and then I made myself read them the way I would read as a book critic. So I went through and I, you know, looked for telling quotes, and I made documents holding quotes that had to do. And at this point, I was starting to figure out some themes of what I wanted to write about. And if there's one thing I know, it's how to pull quotes to support a thesis statement. So I did that for like a few months. Yeah. Hi. Hi.
Oh.
Long time no see. Oh, it's
dueling questioners.
Hi, Claire.
Hi.
We talked a little bit about, last Monday, we talked a little bit about your article that you've written about the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And something that really hit me about the 90s in your article was about how, you know, guys were making it happen, but then there were these amazing women that you knew that were making it happen. Like Cheryl.
Yeah.
Like you.
Not like
that. How does that feed into the work that you create? Because it's kind of interesting how the 90s fit into feminism and what we experienced here, and that there were all these amazing women that were making things sort of happen behind the scenes, and where they are now. And how did that feed into the work that you now do?
That's a great question. I didn't know it was feeding in at the time. I was really afraid. I think that Seattle had a lot of amazing women doing amazing things, but there were a lot of guys out front being the most public figures of the world that I was in, which was mostly the music world, but all the worlds. We live in a male-dominated world. And so I think that for me, during that time, I had a lot of sense of, what's that thing where women, that I was not really able to do it. That I was not, it's a syndrome. Lucy, what's it called? Imposter syndrome. Yeah, thank you. I had that imposter syndrome thing whenever I tried to write, because it was just, oh, I was just writing about it being a girl, or who cares, or I had nothing to say. And so I think that with all the sort of front-facing men, I don't know, I just didn't feel like I belonged as a voice. That's a story I told myself, because a lot of other women were making other choices. But I will say, one of the reasons that, and Susie Tennant has talked about this, and a lot of people have talked about this, one of the reasons that Seattle became such an amazing place for music is because nobody was looking for so long, right? Like, we were just here doing our weird thing, and people were just making stuff to entertain themselves. And in a weird way, maybe feeling like I was just a girl in the background doing my own thing, maybe that gave me a little room to like figure out what I was doing, just the way the music scene had 10 or 15 years before. Does that make sense, that analogy? Yeah. Hi, Erin.
I haven't been able to put your book down.
Oh, thank you.
And also, it's really hard to read.
Yeah, I know.
It's really hard to read. I also started crying when I was 44, And I think my mom did. And I'm wondering if you talked to your mom about whether she had a similar experience, or like, I'm wondering generationally if this happens to all of us.
What about your mom? Tell me what your mom said.
Well, I didn't talk to her about it. I just observed the crazy.
Really? Like, did she go to bed, or like, what was her? Sorry.
She became an alcoholic drug addict and slept with a
lot. Oh, well, that. Oh, I'm sorry. That sounds hard.
Thank you for asking.
That might be Claire's answer, too.
Yeah. Yeah, right, exactly. No, I didn't talk to my mom about it. A lot of the time that I was going through a lot of this stuff, I was writing, and I was just trying to figure out what I was experiencing, and I was just, part of it for me was just really private. Like I had a lot of shame. I was really embarrassed of my depression. I mean, I didn't talk about it until I was starting to emerge from it. And I do remember there's a group of friends here. I remember all of us being together last summer, and we were camping. And nobody here did this, but we were all sitting around together, and I was finally talking about my depression. And so one of the guys I don't know very well started mansplaining my depression to me. And I was like, oh yeah, maybe it's good I was quiet about it. So no, I didn't talk to I told my mom I was depressed, and she was super sympathetic, but we didn't get into an in-depth talk. And I couldn't have, I don't think. I was not in a place where I wanted to do that. And I think I was also protecting some little secret writing thing as well.
Hi.
So I just got it tonight. Of course, you read the part, the only part I've read so far.
I know. Sorry, man.
Nice job. So this may already be in here. But I'm wondering, just from what you've explained so far, what you've told Lucy about how to behave in these times, or how not to.
I don't know. She behaves great. I just said her. I don't need to tell her anything.
So nothing about
no
what you did and what she.
She seems fine.
Good job.
That's the honest answer. I'm not like sloughing it off. That's really the, yeah.
I thought it was interesting that you just mentioned protecting a secret writing thing on the heels of also mentioning imposter syndrome.
Uh-huh.
Do you think those two things are at all related or intertwined?
Absolutely. I think that that's a great question. I think that, it relates to my life as a professional writer. I think that, you know, I overcame imposter syndrome by becoming a professional writer, having a professional writing voice, being published in places that I felt were worthy, and getting paid for my writing. And I learned to write a certain way that was, if not authoritative, certainly kind of fit within this framework of, yeah, that it had a certain authority and a certain readiness for publication and a certain formulaicness, which is what journalism has and is part of the joy of writing journalism. Formulas are great. I mean, you slot in and then see what you can do inside a form. This book was different. I wanted to write something that was much more weird and raw and true and immediate and didn't fit. I mean, it's funny because the book plays with form, but didn't fit any preconceived notions about memoir or what I was supposed to be writing. And so I think it was really important that I like squirreled it away. And because I think if I would have let other people look at it, or that feeling, you know, given in to those feelings of imposter syndrome, I think I would have professionalized the writing more and mitigated the project.
So is there any vulnerability left, do you think?
Oh my God. You mean like, did I use up all the vulnerability? Well, I will. That's a great question.
There might be another secret writing thing, right?
No, I was just going to say, I will say my next book that I'm working on right now is a book-length, very authoritative critical work. So maybe not. Yeah. Who knows? Hi.
So speaking of critical, I can't let him off the hook. And I feel like he is. So the comment of it was the fault of the time, the era, and myself. And I feel like the Jack Wolf crap happens in every single era.
Yes.
And so I peeked ahead, I'm halfway through, to Roman Polanski, but just, I would love to hear you explain more kind of how that's sitting in the accountability for
I love that question, and I think it's a question I'd like to answer privately,
yeah.
Just because it's a mixed audience.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you, though. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I wonder how much, whether you wrote your way out of your depression.
Yeah.
And how much the depression had to do, I haven't gotten to that part in the book yet, had to do with having achieved what you wanted, particularly the success of your first book. Was there, I know it wasn't hormonal and menopausal, was there an element of sort of, you know, I've got where I wanted to be, and now what? Or did I bring that girl along with me, and is she waiting to fuck me up again?
Yeah. Jane's a writer. I think it's fairly obvious. I would say that there was definitely part of it has to do with having achieved something. And I mean, I did, my crazy shrink in this book was like, you achieved at the highest level you could, and look, the world still doesn't love you the way you need to be loved.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and I think the desire to be loved animates everything I do as a writer.
Sure.
And it's a question that I'm fascinated by. How do we get enough love? I mean, I think it's a, you know, it's like that, and how do we waste this time on Earth? Like, I think that's one of the big questions for me. So I think that's part of it. I'm very, very uncomfortable with and skeptical of the idea of the writing curing the depression.
Not curing, but a way to figure out what you felt.
Yeah, I think that that's part of it. I don't really write from a cathartic impulse.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what I do is I write through the really difficult stuff, and I write and I write and I write, and then I take all that and all but set it on fire in the backyard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Throw it away.
Yes.
Get rid of it. Nobody wants to read that crap. And then, then I know what I think.
Exactly.
Because I've said it, and then I make it into something pretty.
So you write to know what you think.
Yes, but then I don't. That's not what I publish.
Yeah, that's not what. But
yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. Aw, thank you. Thank you.
So we're going to take about 3 more questions, but after the event, Claire's going to be signing at a table right to the right, your left, and yeah, after you.
I'm going to take 2 of those as the man in the room. So I was wondering, okay, one, if you could talk about why you chose the picture on the cover, and I haven't read the book, but I'm wondering what's going on in that picture. And then 2... a writing tip you gave me that I cherish. I told you I was most inspired when I drank. more creative. I'm wondering what your beverage of choice is. So.
Okay, so the jacket. I don't have a jacket on my
book. She doesn't like to look at it.
That I wish that it was a better story, Abe. It's an okay story. I'm in the back seat of my parents' car, and I'm about 20, and I'm holding one of those really ugly mugs they used to sell at Starbucks in the late 80s, and it's full of gin. And it was just the...
You can't see that mug.
No, in the full picture, you can see the mug. It's just the picture's so ambivalent and has both love and trouble in it, and it just seemed like it did the trick. A friend. Not a boy. And my beverage of choice. I mentioned bourbon on the first page of the book. But I'm trying to watch it. I am. Hi.
Hi, Claire.
Hi, Anne.
Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
So first off, just a little pretext. I am in awe of you that you sat and read all your journals, because about 6 years ago, I threw away about 45 and didn't read them. I just threw them away.
Wow.
Now I wish I hadn't, but it was a moment of, I don't know, whatever it was. But my question, Claire, is, so you talked about how your perfect mom
has
reconciled.
It was not perfect.
Well, I'm just referring to the, as you've referred to them tonight, has reconciled or been gentle with with your younger self.
Mm-hmm.
How does your younger self feel about your current self?
Yeah, that's really sweet. Somebody who is very smart, who's sitting over there in kind of an orangey pink sweater, asked me a question when I was working on this book, and she said, you have all this stuff that you would tell young or teach younger Claire if you could go back in time, but what does she have to tell you? Which I think is a different spin on your question, but one I've spent more time thinking about already. And I do think that there was this way in which I was returned to the value of wasting time, to the kind of luxuriance of melancholy, to the beauty of art, to the, you know, the not having everything have to be, have a point all the time, but letting stuff just be a little bit more in a kind of pointless way. And I think this past few years, I think maybe, you know, I say in the book, what if a woman's version of midlife crisis is stopping doing stuff? And I think that, it doesn't seem like a big, anyway, I think that it felt like, I called it depression or I called it sadness, but maybe I was just stopping so I could learn how to grow as an artist and experience things more deeply and have feelings more deeply in a way I did when I was younger. Because those were the things that mattered to me when I was a kid. Besides kissing, I wanted to grow as an artist and feel things deeply, right? And so I think it's resensitized me. That's a great question. I love that. Thank you.
Give Claire and Cheryl a round of applause.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum. Claire Dieterer spoke with Cheryl Waters at Town Hall Seattle on May 12th. Thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.